Music from Chris Rice. Welcome to our world. 12 and a half minutes after 8 o'clock in the Central Time Zone and 12 and a half past the hour, wherever you happen to be this morning. And Dr. Don Clark just happens to be with us here on the Broken Road this morning. Don, good morning.
Good morning, Jim, and good morning, Dave.
Don is our resident biochemist. Every radio station should have a resident biochemist, and we're blessed with Don and his mind and his presence and his experience. And Don is with Creation Moments. He's a member of the board there. And we talk about science versus faith and creation versus evolution, and we talk about old things. And this morning, Don, I'm going to ask you a question about even older things.
All right. Well, let's have it.
Well, apparently there's this rift developing within the scientific community. You know, we've talked many times about carbon dating here and how they arrive at the age of certain things, organic things, at least with carbon dating. And we've talked with John Delancey, our resident archaeologist, about how they date archaeological findings, you know, by the layers and comparing it with comparable items nearby at the same levels and so forth. Now there's a new system developed within the realm of science that has the dinosaurs go about 70, what is it, billion years old now? 70 million.
Million.
Okay. And they're saying, well, they probably hung out in the Grand Canyon. But other scientists who stick to their standard dating system said, no, couldn't happen because the Grand Canyon is newer than the dinosaurs. Resolve this for us. What's going on?
Well, the new technique that you're referring to is one that actually relies on the content of a mineral called apatite, which is a phosphate-containing mineral, in looking for the residual helium in the mineral. And so when radioactive material, well, like uranium, when uranium decays to lead, it'll eventually decay all the way down to lead. And in that process, 8 helium atoms are released. They're alpha particles, but they turn into helium when they pick up an electron, a couple of electrons. So that's what they're looking for. Now, this was in the Grand Canyon and kind of the rocks in the kind of the riverbed that they were looking at. And they determined, well, based on the amount of helium that's there, it looks like these rocks were 70 million years old and not the 2 to 5 million.
So we're not talking about dating of dinosaurs. We're talking about the dating of the Grand Canyon then.
And yes,
the new system is reporting the Grand Canyon to be much older than established science has believed.
Right. And the standard, the theory goes that the dinosaurs died off at 65 million years or so. And it's claimed that the event that kind of killed off all the dinosaurs was a gigantic asteroid that hit the Earth. And so therefore, if the canyon is 70 million years old, then the dinosaurs should have been around and saw the Grand Canyon and took in that spectacular view.
Yeah, and we'd probably be finding dinosaur bones all over the place down there. Has that happened? Do we know?
I'm not aware that they've found any dinosaur bones. But we can talk about the true nature, if you will, of the Grand Canyon and what really formed it.
Yeah,
because
let's even
in the article that you referenced that was on the Fox News, and is the work of some researchers at the University of Colorado, I think in Denver, and some others out in California, they are supposing, as most geologists suppose, that the Grand Canyon was formed by the Colorado River. Well, if you've ever been to the Grand Canyon, you know that this little river that's trickling through the Grand Canyon could not have moved all that dirt.
It's always seemed like a non sequitur to me. The first time I saw the Grand Canyon, I was awestruck. It was a near religious experience for me. I was 16, totally taken by the place, and I'm thinking that little river covered all this. No way.
Well, the reason it's so little is because it's worn out after moving all that dirt.
It's a tired river.
It's worn down to nothing. It's a Colorado River, and it's pooped. It's exhausted. I mean, no wonder it's so small.
Yeah.
That's the way I've always looked at it. Come on.
Well, Don, how do you explain it? What brought about the Grand Canyon?
Well, you have to look back in history, and if you look from a biblical perspective,
and we do,
we know that there was an event called the flood or the Great Flood. Some people call it the flood of Noah, but it was really the flood of God because he was the one that started it. And so Noah just happened to be around, and he happened to be the one with his family that was saved through this flood. So, but what happened during the flood? There were a lot of geological, you know, events that happened during the flood. I mean, not only did the water rise and the streams, the water come from under the earth, but of course, it rained for 40 days and 40 nights. You know, it rained for a long period of time, and so the whole earth was flooded. But there was a lot of geological activity. We had, that was probably the time when the continents, when the one main continent started breaking apart into various other continents that we have today.
Now we're talking about a 40-day period of the flood. I mean, the Bible tells us that. Are we saying that all this geological action happened within that 40 days, or was this a general era of huge geographic changes, cataclysmic changes?
No, it initiated a number of events, one of which was the continents drifting. Obviously, the continents aren't going to drift away in 40 days, but, you know, from each other. Mm-hmm. But it started the process.
Gotcha.
And there was a lot of volcanic activity during this period of time. So you had a lot of silt, you know, in the air, and ultimately landed on the ground, and was deposited on the ground. You had the start of the ice age, because prior to the flood, the water was warm by the tropical or semi-tropical environment that was around most of the earth. Excuse me. Mm-hmm. And that caused a lot of evaporation of water. And then as more ash was kicked up into the atmosphere by the volcanic activity, that blocked the sunlight. And so the land cooled off a lot faster than the water. And so you had the ice age that was a direct result of the flood. Now, let's move forward probably several hundred years from the flood. Then you had this terrain, which we called North America, that was pretty silty and pretty, there was, obviously volcanic materials all around the area. Then you had this water that needed to dissipate, that was dissipating from the earth quite rapidly. And it was actually the residual of the flood waters that caused the Grand Canyon. So as the flood waters were receding, there was enough, tremendous amount of water there that could rush through and carve out such a canyon.
And water carrying apparently huge amounts of sand and silt, which would have added to the friction and ground down the rocks that much more quickly, do you think?
Yes, and also a lot of mud and a lot of laying down of various layers because of rushing water. Over probably a fairly short period of time, most of the Grand Canyon was formed, and then there were subsequent mini floods, if you will, or breaking forth of earthen dams that were formed during the process that caused subsequent erosion to that particular area. Now, is there any recent model that kind of shows this type of activity? And the answer to that is yes. Back in the 1980s, we had a mountain in Washington called Mount Rainier, a volcanic mountain, that erupted, and the crater was actually full of ice, which obviously melted and turned into water. That, when the volcano erupted and exploded...
You're not talking about Mount St. Helens now.
Mount St. Helens, okay, yes, that's right. What I'm talking about. Mm-hmm. Yeah, Mount St. Helens. All of that water came rushing down one side of the mountain, stripped every tree that was on that side of the mountain, and eventually landed in the Mirror Lake, which was down at the bottom of the mountain. And so we had a bunch of, I mean, the Mirror Lake was covered with trees and logs and everything from that which was swept down the mountain. But the interesting thing, one of the many interesting things geologically about Mount St. Helens in that event was that it, that water and that mud rushing down the mountain created a crater, created a canyon that was over 100 feet deep in a matter of minutes. Hmm. So,
really?
Yes, it did not take a long period of time. And there were actually layers in the canyon, much like we find in the Grand Canyon. Now, the Grand Canyon's a mile deep and not just 100, you know, 110 feet deep. It's a mile deep. So if you, you know, it's not hard to imagine that multiple volcanic eruptions laying down all the silt, you know, from the volcanic activity could, you know, produce something that with the tremendous amount of water that was trying to vacate the Earth or, you know, North America at that time could carve out a canyon a mile deep.
Now, I remember from the 80s, Mount St. Helens erupting, and people then were saying that it would be generations before it could ever come back to what it was. It was such a gorgeous place, such a peaceful place, such a haven for wildlife and the flora and the fauna and everything. What has happened since then? Because it's only been, what, 20, 25 years. What's it like there now?
Well, unfortunately, I didn't get to go to Mount St. Helens.
You were just up in Seattle. That's
in
true.
Seattle, yeah. Which I wanted to do, but yeah, we were too busy at the time. But trees are coming back. The wildlife has come back into the area. You know, we're getting reforestation. Another interesting thing: the trees that were on top of the lake, floating on top of the lake, they have. Many of them were saturated with water and then are standing upright in the lake bottom in multiple layers of this mud. And so it looks like it's forming a little petrified forest under the water. So this little microcosm of this one event explains a lot in what we see kind of nationally and globally as a result of the flood.
Well, was this a lesson to science, Mount St. Helens I'm talking about now? I mean,
it was one of these things that we had the technology to not only know that, well, gee, this mountain's about ready to erupt, didn't know exactly when it was going to happen, but there was, you know, some expansion of the earth at the top of the mountain. And we could go in, you know, post eruption, and once everything settled down, and start doing some analysis. And some folks at the Institute of Creation Research have done quite a bit of analysis post eruption and post this event, and have documented it on their website. And
how has this affected the thinking then of the scientific community with respect to geologic ages? I mean, if we've just seen an example of something that they thought couldn't happen for thousands of years or millions of years, happening in just a few years or maybe a few hundred, in this case, are they reworking their model on the age of the Earth? Are they taking this seriously?
It's an easy extrapolation to a global flood. But if you refuse to believe in a global flood, then you have difficulty, saying that, wow, this type of event happened at the Grand Canyon, for example, which kind of boggles your mind because it's obvious. You know, here's only one tiny little event, although it was a big eruption. Here's only one tiny event that caused this. 100 foot plus canyon to be formed in a matter of minutes, could that, you know, it, but the scientists, a lot of geologists just refuse to draw the connections.
Well, now, you know, we've talked about young Earth versus old Earth, and the proponents of the old Earth are now being confronted on the other side of the time spectrum by people who are saying, no, it's much, much older than you dated it, coming up with an alternate dating system. And they're defending their current systems. I suppose that's a natural thing to do when you've built your career on certain findings and expectations and conclusions. But how much credibility does this new dating system have? Is it going to supplant the old one, or is it just a drop in the bucket here, a flash?
Well,
in the pan?
It's interesting because a similar technique was used by some scientists that collaborated on the RATE project that I mentioned earlier, that the Institute of Creation Research commissioned. They also used residual helium in minerals, in crystals that were in granite, and many of their samples were taken from the Grand Canyon, kind of the same region where these samples were taken, except that they were taken in the layers of the Grand Canyon as opposed to the gravel, if you will, mm-hmm. at the bottom. Their conclusions was that the residual helium that was there was a direct, point you to an Earth that's 6,000 years old. And they based that on a number of things, but the helium analysis that was done was, the residual helium was found in zircon crystals, which is kind of in the black flakes of the mica that's in the granite. And there shouldn't have been any helium around to begin with. Mm-hmm. If it's millions and millions of years old, the helium would have diffused out of the zircon crystals, thousands of years, millions of years earlier. So they did some modeling of diffusion rates of helium out of zirconium crystals and determined and subsequently did some additional experiments and determined that, gee, this data is fitting a 6,000-year-old model as opposed to a 2 million or 5 million or even in this case 70 million-year-old model. It's interesting that we're taking now. It's the helium was in a different mineral than what these current researchers are analyzing, the fact is that we're using kind of the same type of method to determine greatly different ages. And it really is boiled down to what is the diffusion rate in that particular mineral?
Mm-hmm. Well, it seems to me that there's disagreement as to the results based upon the same findings. In other words, scientists of all schools of thought, young, old, and oldest, would say, okay, the methodology is good, but the data suggests this. In other words, a disagreement as to the results. I lost my point. Oh no! I start babbling and just.
Well, but that's what happens in science all the time. I mean, you have you have a certain data, and you're trying to explain the data with a certain model, and you make some assumptions about your model. Obviously, the folks at Institute of Creation Research are making an assumption that the Earth is only 6,000 years old. But
well, who confers credibility on one system or the other then, and says this is the way it should be done? I mean, is there an institution? Is there an international society? Who's the boss in the world of science?
Well, that's why you would like to have unbiased peer review, and these type of things get discussed in an open, peer review forum. And unfortunately, anything dealing with a young Earth has been ostracized from any type of peer review in the normal scientific, community. So the data is discussed within, at least in this case, the data is discussed within the, creation science world, and people will from the outside will criticize it for one reason or, you know, or another and try to say, well, this is the reason why this data is incorrect. But there isn't, like when you publish a paper, for example, your peers within that community review the paper and say, yes, this is a good paper, worthy of being published or not worthy of being published. And unfortunately, these types of creation papers do not get published in normal journal articles.
I'm just contemplating this.
Yeah, one of the first questions I would have, you know, is that I guess by now there are those who are establishment scientists or who are in the organization that publish the magazines and publish the reports and the reviews and all the rest of that. And so they know who the creation scientists are. So they look at names of people who are sending in reports, and the people that are receiving the reports say, oh yeah, this is that nutball from Texas. Or yeah. This is that crazy guy.
They tend to dismiss young Earth thinkers.
So you're saying that there's already a gathering group of people whose reports are denied, do they actually read the reports?
Yes, they're automatically blackballed, if you will, from the scientific the typical, you know, whether it be Nature or whatever, you know, Geology, you know, magazine or whatever, these scientific journals, they're already blackballed. And then it goes even further. I mean, you could be a scientist in, you know, a legitimate university scientist. And if you happen to mention, for example, intelligent design or the possibility that intelligent design could play a role in explaining your results, you are automatically blackballed and you can lose your job.
Hmm. You know, you would think that in the United States in particular, there are enough Bible-believing folk around that there ought to be a critical mass of scientific thinkers from that community that could make themselves heard and would have some credibility. Where are those people? I mean, I think of Creation Moments and all the wonderful work that's done there, but are they being heard?
Well, we have there's thousands of scientists, you know, out there that believe in creation, believe in a young Earth, or, you know, can argue young versus old Earth and this type of thing, and have done, you know, wonderful research and written a lot of, you know, journal articles, which, you know, get published in the Creation Journal, research journal. Mm-hmm. It's a research journal. Mm-hmm. It's the articles are written as scientific papers, so they're a little tough to read for the average person, but, you know, for a scientist, it's a standard article.
Why don't we get these guys together and go down to a Denny's and have a meeting?
That's right.
And invite the press to it, you know, because they like free breakfasts and stuff. Yeah. They can come in and listen to the discussion and then talk about it. Let's get this word. Well, of course, that's what we're trying to do here on Broken Road
Radio.
Right,
exactly. And there are many scientists who are giving, you know, lectures in churches and in various, you know, various forums, and inviting the public. It's not the public that's the problem. It's the scientific, the in quote, established scientific community that's mm-hmm. the problem. And as well as, you know, governmental agencies and various other things, you know, that we have, you know, in this country. Because once you go down the line that, gee, the Earth could be young, or these results point to an intelligent designer, then you have to admit that, well, gee, there could be a possibility of a God. And I'm accountable, you know, to him. Mm-hmm. And that's the real problem with any of this, is that accountability, if people don't want to be accountable, then they can't accept the fact that the world that we see around us points to not only an intelligent designer, but God, the God of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. in the Bible, because the Bible is the most accurate historical document that we have, you know, today. There is no other document on the face of the earth that is as accurate historically, and which is a written record of history, as the Bible.
Well, even secular science should be able to look at that and say this is a very valuable historic document, just from the nature of what the Bible is. Even if they're not believers, they must give it historic credibility, if not spiritual credibility. I mean, but apparently that's not the way they think. And I would have figured scientists would have been delighted in making waves. Now it seems like you toe the mark or you're out of here.
Right. Yeah, no, it's become, you know, very political and very, you know, scientifically incorrect to mention anything about a creator or anything about a young Earth. And, you know, the geology, I mean, I take, driving to Seattle from East Texas, you go through a bunch of countryside and a lot of it you look at and you say, this is a direct result of a global flood. You know, there's the volcanic activity that you see all along the way, the multiple layers, the folded, you know, the folded geology, you know, in Colorado, for example, and many other areas, the Badlands. All of this is pointing to a global flood. And, you know, if it's obvious to me, and I'm not a geologist, if it's obvious to me, then it should be obvious to a lot of other people.
Well, now I'm embarrassed because I drive that same country and I'm just looking at how many different license plates I can see. Where have I been?
Yeah, and, you know, people, you know, are amazed at even petrified, you know, a petrified forest, for example, and how did that form? Well, how did it form? Mm-hmm. Did it form in just, you know, a dry bed? Well, no, there had to be water around. There had to be water with a lot of minerals in it, and there had to be some warm water. Well, where do you get warm water with a lot of minerals? You get it through volcanic activity, and you get it through a flood.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So, well, this is not...
Should be patently.
It shouldn't be rocket science, you know.
Yeah. Well, now here's another example, just briefly, and this may be fair game. You'll have to decide for next Monday's conversation with you, Dr. Don. But Dr. Eben Alexander has been in the news recently with his New York Times bestseller on his near-death experience. I first saw his story on Nightline, and he's a neurosurgeon who had an attack of bacterial meningitis, E. coli caused. His own examination of his medical records says that at the time of this experience he had, his brain was virtually dead. It was non-functioning. The doctors had given him a 2% chance of survival. And if he did happen to survive, he would be a vegetable. Well, he was in a coma for a week, and now he's perfectly normal and practicing again. And I've seen live interviews with the man, and he's a decent human being and a very bright guy. And he's told us this fantastic story, and maybe we can get into this next week. But my point in this is, now that he's published his account and told the world that he's a neurosurgeon, other neurosurgeons or other people in the medical profession in connected areas are coming back and saying, no, your analysis of your medical records was wrong. Your story is nonsense. It's hooey. Now, I'm speculating on the motivation of these people who want to counter his story. You know, either they suspect his motives, that he's a publicity hound, he's a charlatan, he's a dreamer maybe, or he's just a bad doctor and they want to set the record straight for the public. Well, I'm questioning their motives themselves. Why do they have to say anything? If you can't say anything nice, why yeah, say anything exactly. at all, kind of, you know?
Right. Yes, and there's many, many books have been written. There's a lot of examples in the literature of, you know, kind of out-of-body experiences, and yeah, that'd be a great topic.
I mean, I want to get into the chemistry of I don't know, how, you know, you're a biochemist. I know you've worked in biological pursuits here, but what do you know about brain chemistry?
I'm not a
doctor,
a brain
field, yeah.
You know, chemist, other than the, you know, I know the chemistry behind you know, nerve impulses and things like that, mm-hmm. and what causes them and what doesn't cause them, and the various type of receptors that are on nerve cells and things like that. Mm-hmm. But it sounds like to me that this particular, and I haven't read the book.
And I haven't read the book. I've seen the couple of reviews of the book and a live interview with Dr. Alexander, and I tend to think he's a credible guy. So why don't we kind of look into this for next week? But my main point here was the reaction by the medical establishment to his story, because he went in being a non-believer. Now he's a total believer.
Mm-hmm.
Something
yeah,
accounted for that.
Isn't God
change.
Gracious?
and he was in this almost. Case, and he had a message not only for Dr. Alexander but for us. And I think maybe we'll go into that next Monday with your permission, and you can give you a week here to take a look at some of the documentation of what he's experienced and what he claims. And David, any last thoughts here before we close off?
No, not really. Not really. That was the kind of the topic that was talked about in church yesterday. Isn't that incredible that God will do the things that He does, just to kind of remind us that yes, He's still around, and yes, He's doing these things, and oh yes, by the way, here I am. I'm still here. Remember me.
Mm-hmm.
But He just kind of reminds us every once in a while. I was just thinking about something about. I remember what it was now. There was a guy that we had Bible study last week, and he gave me the disc of a guy who wrote the book, The Last Jihad. And he's talking about the end times and the last days, and are we living in them, and that sort of thing. And the guy that loaned them to me, when I gave them back to him, he said, did you ever think that perhaps Hurricane Sandy was some sort of retribution because we're not backing Israel? I never thought of that. I just like, well, of course it is. I've never put that together.
I would give that zero credibility. I just don't react to that kind of thing that way. But anyway.
There's another book you folks should read if you haven't read it. It's called The Harbinger. And that's what the topic is. God warning us about things to come because of our turning away from Israel.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Well, yeah. The warning I can see, but retribution I can't see.
Well, it's just maybe it's a little louder warning.
the earlier
warnings that didn't cause any damage didn't seem to take anybody's notice.
And we'll wade into this area next Monday when again Dr. Don joins us from Garden Valley, Texas. How the grapes doing? Are they all asleep for the winter?
Yes, they're sleeping. The leaves are almost completely off. Okay. We had a very rapid cool down last night. It was 70 degrees yesterday, and got up this morning, and it was 34 degrees. So,
we're doing our best for you. It's 5 below here. We'll send some of that down as well, too. So.
Yeah.
Don, thanks very much. Dr. Don is with Creation Moments. You can link to them and learn more about that organization and the wonderful things, the information tools they have for you at creationmoments.com. You can link to them right from our website at brokenroadradio.com. Don, be blessed. We'll talk to you next Monday.
Okay, very good. Talk to you later.
See you, Don.
Music from Steve Bell.